Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou, and joined in studio by our longtime host, Brian Becker. Donald Trump is in China today for the first time in his presidency for a high-profile summit with President Xi Jinping. The two leaders will discuss a range of issues of diplomatic, military, and economic importance. We'll spend this full hour talking about the big geopolitical implications of this encounter. We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She was London Mayor Ken Livingston's advisor on culture and creative industries and is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. And we are joined from Toronto by political analyst and writer Ajit Singh. Welcome, Jude and Ajit.
Hi there.
Happy to be here.
So, Jude, let's start with you. What are the big issues? What are the goals for both U.S. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping as their two-day series of meetings get underway?
Well, I mean, they're different for each side. I mean, from China's point of view, I think they want to, it's quite clear, they want stability, calm. They don't want to be diverted into some big confrontation with the U.S. Donald Trump wants some concessions on trade, wants China to step in hard on North Korea. What Trump can't decide is whether he's really interested in some settled, stable relationship with China, or whether he wants to heat things up. Anyway, whatever Xi Jinping puts on the table.
Yeah, Ajit Singh, you know, Donald Trump's policy towards China is kind of hard to discern to the extent that one exists. I mean, with the Obama administration, it was pretty clear. It was the pivot to Asia strategy whereby, you know, the U.S. Military assets and especially its naval assets would be redirected towards the Pacific in this military effort to contain China, and then that would be sort of parallel to the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this you know, big neoliberal trade agreement that the U.S. would sort of put forward as an alternative to economic relations and trade with China. What is Donald Trump's approach to China, and how has that sort of gone through an evolution?
Yeah, I think Donald Trump's approach to China has been a little bit difficult to discern. When he was first elected as president, he accepted a phone call from the leader of Taiwan, and it sort of was an aggressive act and insulting act towards China. Of course, China expects the international community to respect the One China policy and not treat Taiwan as if it's a sovereign nation. And so it sort of started off on a rocky start. Donald Trump later went back on that and acknowledged the One China policy. He's not been as belligerent in his rhetoric towards China, although he continues to point out what he calls a horrible trade deficit and other things like this. Yesterday, he released the Victims of Communism statement just before visiting China, which is, of course, governed by the Communist Party, and talking about the horrible oppressiveness of communism. But he seems to be open towards at least maintaining a polite relationship on the surface with China, as opposed to a very antagonistic, unconstructive relationship. It's interesting because it seems that at least if one looks at the corporate media establishment and the broader political establishment in the United States, there seems to be different orientations towards China. And sometimes a lot of expressions of disappointment with Donald Trump's approach. You can see lots of the representation as being Donald Trump as sort of being a dupe for Xi Jinping and allowing China to play more of a leading role in international affairs due to what's perceived as Donald Trump's America First isolationism, retreating from various international agreements. So it's sort of unclear to decipher what Donald Trump's approach is and what the broader political establishment approach is, because there seem to be contradictory viewpoints.
I want to ask both of you about Trump's speech before the South Korean Assembly, which was, I consider, one of the most bellicose warlike aggressor speeches demonizing North Korea. I mean, on and on and on. Also, we call on every nation, including China and Russia, to fully implement UN Security Council resolutions, downgrade diplomatic relations with the regime, and sever all ties of trade and technology. It is our responsibility and our duty to confront this regime together, because the longer we wait, the greater the danger grows and the fewer the options become. He also called the North Korean regime a rogue regime that the world cannot allow to exist. It seems to me, Jude and Ajit, that, you know, given the historic relationship between the DPRK and the People's Republic of China and the two ruling parties, I mean, Koreans fought as part of the Chinese Revolution between 1945 and 49 when the North Koreans first had state power. And then, of course, the Chinese sent more than 1 million volunteers in to repel the U.S. below and force it back below the 38th parallel in the Korean War. Of course, the relations seem to have deteriorated between China and the DPRK. But do you think that under this kind of pressure from Trump, that that China will sort of go along and with some other greater sanction against the DPRK? And what will the impact be on North Korea?
Well, on the first question, I think not. I think that Trump has very limited options. We discussed before on a previous interview on your program that actually, as Steve Bannon said, who's a complete hawk in relation to the foreign policy he advocated Trump pursues, he said there's no military option in relation to North Korea. The U.S. has very limited options, but Trump has made it his, you know, particularly by adding in all these personal insults to Kim Jong-un, calling him Rocket Man, etc., made it a bit of an issue of his personal prestige, whether what is done about it. So calling for bigger sanctions, downgrading ties, all these sorts of things, these are the kind of things where China can turn around and say, well, we've done all that. You know, so I think it's hot air, to be perfectly honest.
Ajit, your response.
Yes, I don't see China going along with any further sanctions, certainly not any unilateral sanctions that are simply demanded by the United States and not supported by the broader international community, which China opposes. I think we've seen in regards to the sanctions that have been imposed upon North Korea, both China and Russia have sought to soften the sanctions. The United States initially saw a full oil embargo against the DPRK, or Democratic People's Republic of Korea. It was reported that food exports to North Korea from China were up about 100 levels, 100-fold year over year in July and August. And recently, China was pressed, as the United States and other countries continue to say that China is not implementing properly UN sanctions, that it is properly implementing UN sanctions, but that UN sanctions are not meant to hurt the humanitarian needs and livelihood of the Korean people. So I think China's going to maintain a firmness on the idea that while it opposes the nuclear weapons development that North Korea is pursuing, it does not want to, doesn't demonize the country in the same way, and it's not going to engage in just overly brutal or threatening sanctions towards the Korean people's livelihood just because the United States demands it.
Of course, the Chinese government, Jude, as you have stated earlier, wants stability. They want to avoid any sort of confrontation that starts to get out of hand. They're trying to also, recognizing that there are divisions within the U.S. government about what its relationship should be with China, they're trying to position themselves in such a way so as not to inflame anti-China sentiment within the U.S. government. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of concerns and considerations. And at the same time, you have the Chinese dealing with a president who says one thing one day, another thing the next day, lots of bluster and bluff. Nobody really knows what Trump's bottom line is, although everyone knows kind of what China's bottom line is. I'm looking at the Global Times, which is an unofficial website, an unofficial meaning not really the organ of the Communist Party of China or the government, but it frequently is expected to reflect or does reflect the views of the Chinese leadership or some important sectors within it. The headline today is China-U.S. trade gap requires adjustments. And the first sentence is, the trade gap between China and the United States, especially in merchandise trade, is a longstanding bilateral issue. In 2016, China's trade surplus with the U.S. was $254 billion, according to Chinese statistics, while the U.S. put the figure at $366 billion. Then it says, the article basically goes on and says, essentially that China might need to make some adjustments or concessions so as to alter the trade balance so that it's not so gaping. Help our audience, and most of our audience won't be economists and won't be paying careful attention to this, understand, one, what is the trade balance? Why is it significant if it, in fact, is significant? And why would the Chinese be sort of, well, it seemed to me, sort of trying to listen to Donald Trump on this issue, maybe give Donald Trump something or at least something in appearance, if you would help us sort of unpack some of that.
Well, the trade balance is quite simple. It is the imports into China from the U.S. compared to imports into the U.S. from China. And at the moment, the U.S. is importing in value terms far more from China in price terms than China is from the U.S. However, it's really not rather misleading to look at trade balances in terms of bilateral relations, but we know that Trump always wants to look at things in terms of bilateral relations because you have to look at what is the overall situation in terms of countries may have a positive trade balance with one country, but a very negative trade balance with another, and this all balances out. However, it is for the United States has been having problems with its capacity to maintain its export markets across the picture, not just with China. It has a large trade deficit with Japan. It has a trade deficit with Germany. Because it is becoming less and less competitive. Its economy is less and less competitive. Now, China, there are things China can do to mitigate that by, for example, as it has done, I think it was agreed it will import considerably more U.S. beef and pork and do things like this. But in the final analysis, these things are reflections of the fundamental strengths and capacities of the individual economies. And this is really a reflection of the fact that the U.S. economy is not in very good shape and it's not going to be sorted out by trade concessions by China. It can only be sorted out by what kind of domestic economic policies are pursued that can reboot the U.S. economy.
Ajit, that was a big message of the Trump administration, well before it was the administration, when it was campaigning, was that Americans were losing their jobs, the American manufacturing sector was being depleted because of China was taking advantage of America. And the figures that he would point to would be the trade surplus. As Jude is pointing out, United States is importing a lot more, $200 billion more than it is selling to China. But there's another issue in this, and I want you to help the audience explain it. China does a lot of manufacturing for foreign businesses, including U.S. companies. In other words, a U.S. company goes to China, it sets up shop in China, it employs Chinese labor, labor that's employed because it can be paid a lower wage than, say, in the United States or elsewhere. They assemble or do the final end, in many cases, of manufacture, and then those products are sold back to the world market, including to the U.S. market. And thus, they come from China, but they're not really, they are made in China, but they're made in China by Western corporations, including American corporations. So that too has a distorting impact on what these numbers mean. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, Since 1978, China's pursued a policy of reform and opening up, whereby, as you mentioned, as you outlined, Western corporations have been able to invest and engage in various manufacturing projects in China, taking advantage of China's lower labor costs. So what we see here with the United States and Donald Trump criticizing China for trade deficits is has to be looked at also as a criticism of the United States' own policy of taking manufacturing out of the country by corporations and private companies and hollowing out the United States' own economy, which we saw played a big factor in the most recent election. And so when they talk about this trade deficit, sort of is an indictment of the United States' system of hollowing out its own manufacturing economy and moving it elsewhere and reducing the livelihood of America's own working class. There's also another issue which the United States takes issue with China, and we saw the Secretary of Commerce penned an editorial in the Financial Times a few months back talking about how China was stealing the genius of America and the technology of America. One of the policies that China's pursued, while it allows Western corporations to invest there, in the long term, it has been seeking to eventually become independent from Western corporations because, and it seeks to do that by over time gaining the technologies and through technology transfers from these corporations and learning how to use them. Because of course, China has a history of underdevelopment, and it didn't have a robust economy yet at the time it engaged in reform and opening up. And so there's also a resentment being targeted towards China that China is now gaining independence from these Western corporations and is less dependent upon them. And it's harder for those corporations to go there and make the exorbitant profits they had before.
That's the voice of Ajit Singh. We're talking to him from Toronto. We're also talking from London with Jude Woodward. She was London Mayor Ken Livingstone's advisor on culture and creative industries, and she is the author of a new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're going to stay with this topic of Donald Trump's trip to Asia when we come back after a very short break. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
We're spending the full hour, this hour, talking about Donald Trump's trip to Asia. Donald Trump is in China today for the first time in his presidency for a high-profile summit with President Xi Jinping. The two leaders are discussing a range of diplomatic, military, and economic issues. We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She is the author of a new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. And we're joined from Toronto, Canada, by political analyst and writer Ajit Singh. Let's stay a little bit longer on the issue of imports, exports, economics. Donald Trump, as we talked about in the first segment, was blaming China. China's a currency manipulator, he said. China's taking advantage of America. China's selling things to America, but not buying things from America. It's just so unjust. He painted this dark picture of China sort of taking over and humbling America. Jude, China's economy produced $21.27 trillion in goods in 2016 based on purchasing power parity, thus becoming in aggregate the world's largest economy. The European Union is second at $19.1 trillion. The United States fell to third place, producing $18.5 trillion. So in those big aggregate numbers, it looks like China first, EU second, the United States third. But that actually doesn't, in fact, tell the story. Help the audience understand why, even though in aggregate China may be the largest economy, that's not really quite in terms of the relationship of forces between the American economy and China.
Well, obviously, actually, there are things which mitigate those figures, which because while China on those figures is the largest economy in the world, it certainly doesn't have the same inherent strength as the US economy or indeed the European economy as yet. And of course, China itself doesn't like those PPP measures, though most economists would accept them. But we should understand that these figures are significant in their own right. This is the first time since America became the largest economy in the world. There's no one alive in the world that has lived in a world that where America wasn't the largest economy in the world. And now China is, probably, at least by PPP measures. However, and that's a very significant fact, and that is a lot lies behind a lot of America's worry about the rise of China, what this is all going to mean, et cetera. But of course, this doesn't mean that China still has nothing like the GDP per head of Europe, the main countries of Europe, of the United States, etc. It doesn't have the same high-tech developed in multinational high-tech companies. It is now beginning to develop some very important international companies of its own, but not on the scale of America or Germany. And its military capacities are nothing like at the level of the United States, so these are growing. So although it's become the larger economy, it's not yet got the same fundamental national strength. And it will be some time, several decades, before on present rates of growth it would be a challenge to the United States at an all-round level. But nonetheless, this is a very important fact and lies behind Donald Trump's big agitation on the matter. But fundamentally, this is a reflection of America's economic problems, not that China has done something bad to the United States. The United States is a victim of its own economic mantras, you know, the free market, the hidden hand of the market, trickle-down economics, small state, the Washington Consensus, neoliberalism, all of this doesn't work fundamentally. And the alternative path pursued by China, which we can, you know, China describes as socialism with Chinese characteristics or whatever you want to call it as, it's not that system. And it works considerably better than the U.S. system, but the U.S. is trapped by its own ideology.
Ajit Singh, another key difference between the U.S. and Chinese economy is that, you know, the United States has Wall Street, right? The U.S. economy is dominated by the big banks, by financial entities and, you know, quote unquote, shadow banking by these private equity funds. It's, you know, the majority of the population might work in the service industry, but the dominant sector of the economy is without a doubt the big banks, finance capital. China is structured in a fundamentally different way, right? Tell us how the Chinese economy is structured and why does that matter when it comes to U.S.-China relations?
Yeah, so I'd say the fundamental difference between the Chinese and United States economies is that in the United States, definitively, the economy is dominated by the interests of Wall Street and by the interests of wealth. Whereas in China, while there is inequality, especially as it's pursued reform and opening up in order to build up its productive forces and the productivity of its economy, this is not the case. Capital or wealth doesn't have that sort of dominant role over politics and the economy as it does in the United States, while it seeks to make use of capitalists and of capital and of foreign investment, it seeks to make use of them within firm guidelines. And when capitalists or foreign companies step outside of these guidelines, China's ruling party, the Communist Party, is very quick to to clamp down on that. And I think that's really the fundamental difference. So whereas you'd see something like in the United States, the 2008 financial crisis result in extreme bailouts given to big banks and Wall Street, and no real punishment, that they went free with impunity. In China, when you see private enterprises or businessmen or entrepreneurs engage in corrupt acts or in acts which are outside of the orientation and direction that the government wants to go into, you often see these people get arrested and even executed at times. And I really think this dictates the fundamental difference, and it allows China to make decisions which are more in the interests of its people and its nation, and long-term things like transitioning to a green economy. China is now the world leader in renewable energy production and renewable energy employment. And it's really playing the leading role in reducing the cost of solar energy production and renewable energy production. It allows China to do things like lift hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, be on pace to eradicate poverty, which is really something incomparable across the global south, and things like that, which we really see impossible to really do within the United States political system, these sort of people-centered, environment-centered, non-destructive pursuit of profit interests have any, like, they don't really have the same stake in U.S. politics.
I'm looking at an article in 2013, so it's quite old. It's 4 years old. It's interesting, though, because I want to pick it up because it's along the lines of what Jude is, what Ajit is talking about. And I want to see if Jude agrees that there is a there's obviously a capitalist class, and there are millionaires, multimillionaires, billionaires in China. This article says this: in the last 15 years, China has produced greater overall wealth than any country. The number of its billionaires has also grown from a mere 15 to around 250 in just 6 years. But for a number of these people, this vaulted status is short-lived. According to one study, 17% of those on that list end up going to prison. I mean, that's quite a staggering number. 17% of the, I mean, I guess you don't want to be on that list. Anyway, Jude, go ahead.
Well, I think that's a reflection of the fact that China is much tougher on corruption. We've just had the release of and its rules on what companies can do are much stricter, and people have to adhere to them. It would not allow the kind of situation which we've just seen in the released so-called Paradise Papers, where companies are stashing their billions in offshore accounts to avoid tax, etc., etc. And the attempts to do this in China are cracked down on. So I think one would happily be part of that list as long as one was prepared to abide by the rules. But there's less scope for bending the rules or avoiding the rules in China than there is in the West. I think that's what that comes down to. The kind of activities which we've seen in the Paradise Papers would have led in China to a whole load of people being in prison.
Let's go to another point on this trip, Donald Trump's trip to Asia, and today he's in China, and he'll be there tomorrow. Global Times, again, the newspaper website that I referred to before, an unofficial, not representing the views officially of the Communist Party, but frequently cited as a source that maybe reflects those views. It says in the first paragraph, the headline is, Trump visit instills positive factors to Sino-U.S. ties. U.S. President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump visited the Forbidden City on Wednesday afternoon and were later welcomed with a series of well-arranged receptions. Trump is one of the most popular heads of state on the Chinese internet, and generally, the Chinese public holds a very positive attitude towards him. Ajit, do you think that's true? Do you think the Global Times is trying to just flatter Trump, or do you think there's something to this?
I don't know. I think it was interesting. I was watching a video segment from Chinese state media, Xinhua, last week. It was ahead of the visit, and it was interviewing just ordinary Chinese people about what do you think about Donald Trump? What do you think about U.S.-China relations and questions of that nature? And most people were very diplomatic in how they appraised Donald Trump and what he means in U.S.-China relations. But they were very firm when the question came to international relations and how you think the United States treats China internationally. And I think there was a high level of consciousness that that at least this one segment reflected, an anecdote, of course, that it sees the United States clearly as trying to contain China's rise and as trying to prevent a real challenge to U.S. unipolar hegemony. So I think there are two things going on. I think one, China's very shrewd tactically and doesn't really want to provoke any sort of unnecessary tensions with Donald Trump, given how inflammatory and erratic his individual personality really is. And so I think they really don't want to get engaged in any of that. So they're going to try and appease him and engage and be as polite and diplomatic as possible. And so you see something like this in the Global Times article. But I think underneath that, they're very well aware that he doesn't really represent any sort of shift from the United States consensus of trying to contain China, pivot to China, and really see China as a threat to U.S. unipolar dominance, which is the dominant view of the United States political establishment.
I want to get your opinion about it, too, Jude. I'm really curious about this. I mean, the article in the Global Times, and it's like a lead article. It's an editorial. It says, many leading U.S. media outlets are now discredited among the Chinese public, partly because of their fake reports during the elections and subjective opposition against Trump. What do the Chinese people see in Trump? First, Chinese appreciate his directness, which is in sharp contrast to Hillary Clinton, who always puts on airs. This has won him popularity since the election campaign. Many may feel he may stick to his own ideas, but he is not insidious. Trump seems to be pragmatic on his Beijing policy and has no interest in ideological diplomacy. He hasn't used the issue of human rights to make trouble for China so far. And this means the Sino-U.S. relationship can focus on substantive matters. It seems to me, when I read that article, and recognizing that diplomacy is always a form of international perjury in a way, in other words, not actually absolutely 100% honest, but trying to achieve certain gains through the diplomatic channels, it seems like a huge amount of personal flattery to Donald Trump on the issues that matter most to Trump, the election, Hillary Clinton, the media. Do you see it that way, or is this an authentic representation of how you think a broader part of the Chinese public views things?
Well, let's be clear. There's no doubt at all that at the time of the election last year, there were immense illusions in Donald Trump in China. If you followed the sort of internet sort of noise, there was a lot of support for Trump, primarily because Hillary Clinton was so hated, or is so hated. She is hated, not for whatever psychological reasons were said in the article, quite simply, but she was the architect of the US pivot to Asia, or pivot to China, as it should be more accurately understood, and was held responsible for a new aggressive policy by the United States, which led to a lot of instability, military build-up, particularly the problems in the South China Sea, etc. So I would say it's not at all inaccurate that the conscious, politically conscious Chinese people were probably in their majority rooting for Trump and had some illusions as to what that would mean about U.S. policy towards China. I think then his various things he's done, even though that he may have his own motives for them, which we might see very differently here, have been seen rather positively in China. So, for example, pulling out of the TPP undoubtedly was a very popular move in China. It wasn't popular with the Asian partners who had lined up behind the TPP and gone through considerable internal turmoil to get their governments to agree to it. But for China, this was a big pressure was taken off. And so for a whole variety of reasons, which Trump isn't conscious of at all, I think that there's some truth that he is seen rather more favorably in China, for example, than he is in the West. But there's also a huge amount of flattery in this, because, as we said at the beginning, what China most wants in its relations with the U.S. is stability and not some big confrontation.
Ajit Singh, this isn't the first time that Donald Trump and President Xi Jinping have met. We just have about 1 minute. We can take this up after we come back from break. But when they met in the United States in April, you know, they talked about these economic issues. They talked about trade, about technology transfers. But the big thing in my mind that happened is that Donald Trump bombed Syria while he was meeting with President Xi Jinping. You know, they were having dessert. And then he said, oh, isn't this a lovely cake? Blah, blah, blah. And by the way, I just sent several dozen cruise missiles at an airbase in Syria. What effect do you think that had on how the Chinese leadership perceived the Trump administration?
But don't answer that question, because we have to go to a break. And after we come back, we'll have Ajit Singh answer the question. We're talking with Ajit Singh and Jude Woodward about Donald Trump's trip to Asia. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
We're spending the full hour talking about Donald Trump's trip to Asia. He's in China today for a meeting with President Xi Jinping. Sightseeing today, meetings tomorrow. The two leaders are discussing a range of issues of diplomatic, military, and economic import. We are joined from London by Jude Woodward. She is an author of The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War, and from Toronto, Canada, by political analyst and writer Ajit Singh. Ajit, before we went to break, Walter asked you a question framing the first meeting between Trump and Xi Jinping back in Mar-a-Lago in Florida at Trump's luxury hotel, where while serving him dessert, Trump informed him that he had just launched 59 cruise missiles against Syria. Pick up with your answer, if you would.
Yeah, I think that would have, Donald Trump's actions there during the first meeting would have really erased any illusions that anyone within the Chinese political apparatus would have had that Donald Trump is some sort of a big jump from the rest of the political establishment, despite various superficial differences in his personality. I think it really would have alerted the Chinese political establishment that this is someone who's very erratic and someone that you have to be very cautious with. And I think it's interesting. Yesterday, it seems like Donald Trump might have tried a sort of round two of that sort of surprise, off-balance throwing type tactic. It was reported that while he initially said he wasn't going to visit the demilitarized zone at the border of North and South Korea, which would have been a very provocative action, it seemed there were some sort of conflicting reports that he might have tried to visit but wasn't able to due to inclement weather. So he might have tried another round of that this visit. I think it's what we've seen over China over the past year is a lot of expressions of making sure that the Chinese military remains under the firm leadership of the Communist Party and the government, and that it doesn't stray from this leadership. And we heard at the recent party congress, Xi Jinping state that, and then he followed it up visiting the army and the military and making the same statement that the Chinese military and the point of a military is to be able to engage in combat and to be able to win and to be able to win wars. So I think at the same time, while China engages in flattery and maybe might have some illusions about opportunities for constructive relations with Donald Trump, I think they're firmly aware that, and were certainly awakened to that in their first visit, that this is someone who doesn't really mark a decisive shift from U.S. strategies of containment and aggression towards China.
Let's talk about the relationship, and I think it's evolved, and I want to get both of your opinions on this. The relationship between the United States and South Korea, Japan, and China in the last few months under the leadership of Trump, and I want to get your take on it, You had the Chinese government really not breaking relations, but really deteriorating purposefully its relations with South Korea when the South Korean government allowed the United States to deploy THAAD. Moon Jae-in came in, a reform president, purportedly a liberal, someone who might be willing to reach out to North Korea. And then you had Donald Trump, in the face of North Korean nuclear tests and missile technology tests, ramping up the rhetoric big time, fire and fury, an armada to Korea. And at the same time, Moon Jae-in moved off of any sort of progressive position, basically embracing a hardline military approach against North Korea. They added a second deployment of THAAD, more THAAD commitments. And at the same time, the People's Republic of China said, well, we're going to strengthen our relations back now with South Korea, meaning even though they had deployed THAAD, which China perceived to be a direct threat to China, it was kind of like, let's bygones be bygones and move on and make it closer and better relationship. At the same time that Trump is ratcheting things up against North Korea in the most provocative, bombastic, bellicose way, it seems to me that Donald Trump has succeeded in some ways in shifting the political compass a little bit everywhere as a consequence of both offering a better relationship with China, flattering the Chinese leadership, they both flattering each other, of course, which is part of diplomacy, playing tough guy when it comes with South Korea. And now the Chinese, even though the United States has deployed THAAD a second time or is committed to in South Korea, improving relations with South Korea under those circumstances. It feels like Trump is somewhat succeeding in moving everyone more in the direction of this position of the United States. Do you see it that way, Jude, or is this, that's just smoke and mirrors on the part of the Chinese?
Well, I don't see it quite like that, actually, because I think Trump made a complete mess of U.S. relations with South Korea in the run-up to the election, and because he threatened to pull out of the bilateral trade agreement with South Korea in the context of the election, made some statement that the U.S. was going to expect South Korea to pay for THAAD when THAAD was already deeply unpopular in South Korea. And that actually had some quite negative effect from the U.S. point of view on the election, because it wasn't looking at all certain that Moon would win. So, and Moon was the most pro-rapprochement with DPRK, had said he wouldn't station THAAD, though, of course, changed his mind. Then the situation, if you like, from the point of view of the U.S., was in a certain sense aided then by the nuclear crisis that blew up with North Korea, because this created the situation to persuade Moon to change his position on THAAD. This then led to a big blow-up with China. I think China handles its diplomatic relations on the whole extremely skillfully, but this situation went out of control rather fast, and because I think that China wants good relations with South Korea and not bad ones. Now, obviously, the intention and the hope was that South Korea could be persuaded not to station THAAD, and China was prepared to put on a great deal of pressure to achieve this, but not to the degree of a breakdown in the end in relations with South Korea. So I think this is quite a sensible turn by China to rebuild relations with South Korea, because over the whole previous period, relations between China and South Korea were rather wrong-footing the US rather than the other way around. And I think China is quite keen to get back to that situation. So I think we'll see how it plays out. But I don't think the U.S. has got very much out of the situation so far. It's got the stationing of THAAD, but it was looking like it would get that anyway. And really, if anything is to blame for that, it's the situation in North Korea, which obviously the U.S. in the final analysis is also responsible for. But so in that sense, it's got something it wanted. But I don't think fundamentally it's shifted relations with South Korea substantially in its favor.
Ajit Singh, when Donald Trump began this tour of Asia, China is his third stop. First, he went to Japan, then he went to South Korea, and now he's in China and will be there tomorrow. When the trip first began, there were joint naval drills carried out by the U.S. Navy, a carrier that the U.S. Navy has stationed near China and near Korea, the USS Ronald Reagan. And they were drilling with Japanese and Indian vessels. So not only is the United States seeking to place pressure on Korea and China using its own military might, it also has, you know, relatively powerful allies in the region that it seeks to use as pressure points. But of course, Japan and India also have their own independent interests. Could you comment on that for a moment? Will the United States be able to use its, well, in the case of Japan, traditional alliance to place additional pressure on China and try to contain it?
Yes, I think one of the key initiatives of the United States in regards to its China containment strategy is building this sort of quadrilateral alliance between itself, the United States, and Japan, Australia, and India. Japan and Australia, of course, are more traditional allies with the United States. And of course, we've seen in Japan this sort of effort to amend its constitution in order to allow for it to engage in perhaps more hawkish military policies. I think one of the most important developments is in regards to U.S. India relations, which over since really the fall of the Soviet Union, India has really shifted from its traditional orientation as a non-aligned country and part of the non-aligned movement towards one which opened up much more to the West. It liberalized its economy, and it's really developed much more of a closer relationship with the United States and an increasingly subordinate alliance with the United States, subordinate in the sense of being subordinate to U.S. foreign policy interests in the region. And we've seen incredible increases in the amount of bilateral defense trade between the two countries. In recent years, it's jumped from $1 billion to $15 billion. And India, I believe, is currently the world's greatest importer of arms. And so I think India in particular is one of these countries which the United States is trying to pull into its orbit, so it's really able to have regional allies which can play a sort of role on its behalf in containing China, and it's certainly a very sensitive situation.
Jude Woodward, you're the author of the book The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. So that implies, you know, that Asia is being divided into a pro-China and a pro-U.S. camp, right? Looking at the broader regional picture, in addition to India and Japan, which countries do you see lining up more with the United States, and who thinks that the future is really with China and that's the logical alliance to go with?
Well, I mean, I think what's quite interesting is that in the past, if you look at the Cold War or the First Cold War, if you want to use that terminology, almost all the countries in the region, apart from Vietnam and North Korea and Russia, of course, were aligned with the United States. And, of course, the conflict and division between the Soviet Union and China was a crucial component of the US's tactics in the Cold War to keep those two giants separate. This time round is much more complicated for the US because, one, China and Russia are much closer. In fact, are growing closer all the time, and this is a big obstacle to building a real axis against China. Secondly, although it is making inroads in shifting the position of India, a lot of the countries that were traditionally very closely aligned with the United States want to take a more neutral or middle position. So very populous and very economically successful countries, for example, like Indonesia, which were very much aligned with the West and were part of the whole anti-communist consensus. The Communist Party in Indonesia was massacred, etc., etc. It now wants to very much play both sides and doesn't want to get drawn into a sort of anti-China bloc. So I think the situation is very complicated. China, the US is courting Myanmar, which was traditionally very much in China's orbit, but not getting very far because it doesn't have a great deal to offer. It's courting Vietnam because it wants to take advantage of the disagreements that Vietnam has with China over the South China Sea, the islets in the South China Sea, but really is making very little progress. And the Philippines, which was its number one lackey, if you like, has very much shifted its position to, so although Trump gets on much better with Duterte than Obama did, for example, because Trump is not going to go on about human rights in the way that Obama did, nonetheless, the Philippines have shifted from being the sort of oppo for the United States tactics against China to very much improving its relations with China. So I think the big thing for the United States, the big plus, is this new relationship with India, which is why Trump now refers to the Indo-Pacific, and which is both an indication of a genuine strategy and also a big flattery to India. But this will, I think, become the pivot, if you like, of the next stage of the China containment strategies in the U.S. military political establishment.
Yeah, very interesting. New language, the Indo-Pacific region. Right after Trump leaves China, right afterwards, Chinese President Xi Jinping, who is also the General Secretary of the Communist Party of China's Central Committee, will attend the 25th Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. The meeting will be held in the city of Da Nang from Friday to Saturday, and Xi will pay a state visit to Vietnam. Analysts believe that Xi's first overseas visit since the 19th Congress of the Chinese Communist Party will be a significant in terms of strengthening the relationship with Vietnam. The Chinese media is reporting on this trip as well, Ajit, and they're framing it in the context of China's long relationship with Vietnam. Of course, China and Vietnam had a falling out after the Vietnam War, and as perhaps a consequence of the larger Sino-Soviet conflict that was taking place at that time. But the Chinese media is now emphasizing how China stood with the Vietnamese in their fight against French and U.S. imperialism. Talk about China-Vietnam relations. We only have a couple minutes left, but I think it's extremely important. And of course, again, for our audience, Vietnam is not a small country, vital to Southeast Asia, and of course, historically significant for China. We have 3 minutes left. So Ajit, if you would talk a little bit about that, say 90 seconds, and then I'll throw it back to Jude for the final comments.
Yeah, so Vietnam had played in recent years seemed to be featuring a big part in the United States China containment strategy. It was part of the now abandoned TPP agreement. And I think one of the things that's sort of an influence in China's and Vietnam sort of seeking closer relations is that the United States is pursuing this sort of containment strategy with very many countries in the region, like India, Japan, Australia. And so I think these sorts of forces are playing one role in pushing them together, because China and Vietnam, I think, both recognize the challenges and threats that they face. It was interesting earlier this week, there was a release, it was reported that Beijing and Vietnam had come to an agreement to control disputes in the South China Sea, which of course would be a big improvement on the relations, because that's been a source of dispute over recent years. So I think there is a sort of renewed effort to try and mend differences in that relationship, and it could play a very big impact in the regional balance of forces between U.S. containment and China's rise.
Okay, Jude, 90 seconds left again, because you've written the book, the U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. Just help us, as we go out, understand the significance of Xi Jinping's upcoming trip to Vietnam and whether, in fact, it has significance?
Well, I think it has very big significance, but I think making sure that the tensions with Vietnam, which can't all be sorted out immediately because these are the kind of problems which Deng Xiaoping said, the kind of things which wise people decided to put off till tomorrow because they couldn't come to a conclusion today, to make sure that these tensions don't lead to a wider fallout with Vietnam, and there's a way of managing them. And I think that both Vietnam and China want that, and I'm sure they will find solutions. But if that was not the case, then that would become a wedge that the US could drive into the situation to try and widen its alliances to of China containment. So I think this is highly significant visit, and I would expect that the outcome will be very positive, and that Vietnam and China will find new and better ways to both cooperate economically and diplomatically, but to also manage their disagreements over territorial claims in the South China Sea.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. That was Jude Woodward. We've been talking to Jude from London. She is the author of The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. We were also joined from Toronto by political analyst and writer Ajit Singh. Stay with us. After a short break, we'll be talking about the big stories of today on the next hour of Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.